Zach Smolad, by the way. Has anyone tried that? Ralph McGnome. If you're a serious Haskell enthusiast, you want to try a tiling window manager. There's a really nice one called Xmonad where you do everything with your keyboard. If you like Emacs and the feeling of carpal tunnel syndrome coming on at you at 50 miles an hour, Xmonad is great because you just do everything with a keyboard and just damage all your fingers. It's good fun. So Phil, Professor Wardler's away this week, so I'm going to be taking the lecture today. My name's Phil Scott. I was invigilating yesterday. I'm tutoring with some of you. So how did the class test go? Good? Yeah? It's a bit of a weird one, because I mean, you've kind of all sat down like writing out programs, which isn't really a natural way to do programming. So if it went a bit weird yesterday, the main exam is going to be a bit different. It's going to be, you're actually going to have computers, which is a huge advantage to programming, I find. And you're going to have open books as well, so it should all be good. So don't worry about yesterday too much. Just in case you're feeling really depressed about it anyway, we're not going to introduce any new Haskell material in this lecture. We're just going to be looking at a slight side issue about proof. Now, proof is not something you'd normally associate with computer programming. This is probably going to be the only programming course you'll ever do where proof is going to get mentioned. And there's good reason for that. Haskell and proof tend to go together quite well. It's one of these great things about Haskell. It makes it very unique as a language. And you won't find this with Java, which you'll be doing next year. But in Haskell, we can really start talking quite seriously about proving things. Proofs, I mean, obviously there's a lot of baggage to the word proof. There's lots of different ways in which that word could be used. So first off, I might want to start by throwing out the question, what does everyone think a proof is? What do we prove things for? Can anyone give an example of something that they think they can prove? Any ideas? Any thoughts? Just random ones. Come on. Go for it.
I think a proof is a sequence of logical sentences that take you from a hypothesis to a conclusion.
Excellent answer. Cool. Right. So it's a derivation, right? Yeah. So we're going. So we're looking at a series of steps. So like a classic one might be the classic, you know, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. We have all this stuff that philosophers are interested in. Anything else? Any other ideas where the word proof gets used? So we might just have a think about where you might find proofs. Mathematics is a great one for proofs. If you're going to do a mathematics course with the university or some of the later, more advanced mathematics courses, it's pretty much all about proof. The guy depicted here, Euclid, about 2,500 years ago, wrote a book called The Elements, in which all he did was take contemporary knowledge about geometry and he systemized it into a system of proofs, which all come back to these axioms, come back to these incontrovertible principles. And that seems to be like the hallmark of proof, although it's a bit dodgy, because like Euclid wrote this huge book, but the premises weren't actually as uncontroversial as he'd have hoped. And about 100 years ago, a guy called Hilbert said, yeah, I don't reckon Euclid's proofs are actually that good. I don't reckon they're that watertight. So maybe mathematics isn't always unambiguously a place to find proof. We've got science. There seems to be proofs in science, aren't there? Are scientific results proven?
Most scientific results are tested on a large number of examples, and generally they hold true. I mean, in physics at least.
Yep.
They're not all proved.
So not, is anything proved?
Is anything proved?
In science, do you reckon?
But
I think that's the point, isn't it? Like science seems to be more about, it's empirical, right? So it's more about just tests rather than actual proofs. Of course, you've got alcohol and divine revelation, they're sources of proof. Kind of an overlap on those two. This guy, Ben Franklin, said that beer is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy. Not sure whether that was divine revelation he was talking about or he just had too much to drink. So let's get back to some context. We're interested in Haskell. So the sort of things that we're going to be looking at in terms of proof are Haskell proofs, proofs about Haskell programs. And here's an example of a proof. Okay, we've got this function squares, which was from the first lecture, where we take a number. It's a function which takes an integer, returns an integer by just taking the square. And we've got this proposition that we think holds for this function squares. We think that squares of x plus y is going to be equal to x times x plus 2 times x times y plus y times y. Okay, and so to prove that, we do a quick check, and it says passed. It's 100 tests. What are we going to immediately say about that, though? In terms of when we start thinking about proof, this is looking pretty dodgy, right? You know, because it's 100 tests. It's like science again. It's like empirical. You know, we don't want tests. We want fact. You know, we want to know, Garrett, come on, give me a proof. Give me a rigor. So I want to know absolutely that this proposition here is true. A way to categorize different sorts of proofs in terms of precision is these three rules, which are from a book called Thinking Mathematically. So first step, convince yourself. If you haven't convinced yourself, you've definitely not done a proof. It's usually quite easy to convince yourself, though. I tend to think quite highly of myself, so I'm very easy to convince. And then convince a friend. That's okay as well, usually. You know, you can, your friends, if they're sympathetic, if you've got argumentative friends, you might have a problem with convincing friends of things, but generally they're better for convincing. Convincing enemies, that's usually the real pain in the ass, isn't it? You know, take something like, imagine a strong socialist up against a conservative, convincing, you know, trying to convince each other about the budget cuts of university funding. There's going to be a lot of difficult rhetoric there. You're probably, in that conversation, you're probably going to have two people shouting at each other going, well, obviously you're wrong, and no, don't be stupid, this is going to destroy us, and we'll have lots and lots of this rhetorical nonsense. And at that point, we're starting to get starting to really struggle convincing people of different things. But still, I don't think this is the final step. I think the final step is to convince a computer. I think once you can convince a computer, then your proof is definitely precise. Because computers, unlike people, they don't have biases. They don't have beliefs, which is very helpful. Which makes it kind of difficult to convince them of things. But the important thing, of course, about a computer is that they're mechanical. You know, they're stupid. So you don't have to worry about them misunderstanding stuff. You don't have to worry about them having prejudices. You just feed them the data, and if you can push your arguments through, you're pretty certain that they're going to be right. So here's an example of that. This is from your computational logic. This is what a proof that a computer would understand is going to look like. And it's at this point that we're starting to get serious into precise proofs. This is like the absolute furthest end you can get in terms of rigor when it comes to proof. Trouble is that that's a lot of writing to prove something that trivial. A or B and C, comma A. A, comma, A implies D, proves that C or D. If we have to do this for all arguments, we're probably not going to get anywhere fast, but that's the price that we have to pay here. The point about this, of course, is it's just all about systematic rules and mechanical rules. This is the sort of thing that you can really just feed into a computer and get it to check. And that's the whole point about doing the sort of proofs that we do in computational logic and the sort of proofs that we're going to be interested in here. We're not going to be interested in, like, in the sort of proofs that mathematicians are interested in. They're nowhere near as precise for us. Okay, we want something which can be fed through a computer. So why would we do that? Well, it's fun. It really is, honestly. I find it fun. It's at least as fun as functional programming. So if you're enjoying functional programming, you'll enjoy doing proofs. But probably a better argument, if you're more pragmatic as to why to do proofs, is this scenario at the bottom here, fixing bugs in our software. Generally speaking, if you use computers, you're probably quite familiar with bugs. They are generally quite standard. Bugs normally not a problem, and we're just used nowadays to, if your program crashes or there's a bug in our software, just reset it, try again. This is an example of a bug where it's more difficult to do that. On the left, we have a picture of some software starting, and on the right, we have a picture of a piece of software literally crashing. In that case, you're not really going to do well just by trying to reset the computer and try again. That's a bit of a write-off, that one on the right. This is probably the most expensive software bug in history. So one of the points about doing proof to the point where we're not just convincing our enemies, we're also convincing computers, is that we can get absolute guarantees that we're not going to be losing several billion dollars on huge expensive rockets. And that's probably quite a useful thing. So, rule of Leibniz, slide just before we get into some of these proofs. We talked a bit about Leibniz in the first few lectures. Leibniz was a guy who really did believe that proof could be mechanical. It was something that you could just feed through computers. He had this vision that all mathematical knowledge, all argumentation, eventually you could put it into a form where you could just put it into a machine, crank a handle, and it would come out saying, yep, that's good. That's a valid argument. The other thing in sight he had was this idea about equational reasoning, that all of logic somehow boils down to equations and to the idea of equality. And so you've probably had, remember Professor Wardle talking a bit about the identity of indiscernibles and the indiscernibility of identity. If you can't tell two things apart, that means that they have to be the same thing, and two things which are the same, you can't tell apart. More modern idea on this is the last two rules there. Equality is reflexive, so if you have an equation and you've got something on the left and something on the right and they're both the same expression, the equation must be true. Next one, of course, is that equals may always be substituted for equals. And this is a great way of understanding logic. I mean, you can almost boil the whole of logic. You can literally boil logic down to equations, okay? So this is why you can see in the picture that he's feeling quite impressed with himself. He's quite happy. Now he's not happy. The reason he's not happy is because of this. The number I'm thinking of now is not the number I'm thinking of now, okay? That's violated reflexivity of equality. You know, I've got the same thing on the left as on the right, but it's not a true statement, and that's made him quite sad. This isn't a real picture of him, by the way. I've doctored it, in case you haven't noticed. This is an example of that actually happening in programming. This is comes from a language called Java, sometimes known as C++. And it says that I++ is not equal to Y++. That's a standard bit of C++ code, which just violates reflexivity of equality. So we don't like C++. It's why we like functional programming. Here's another problem we've got. Barack Obama equals President of the United States. Okay, that's good. Sounds right. George Washington was President of the United States in 1789. Yeah, sounds good. So substitute equals for equals and... Yeah. Okay, so something's gone wrong here. So basically, Leibniz is talking rubbish. I mean, most of the times in logic and reasoning, his laws don't work. But in mathematics, this is where things are good. This is where in mathematics we can be sure that Leibniz is definitely ruling. And also, he's definitely ruling in Haskell. So now, so long as we're staying in Haskell, we can think in a Leibnizian way. And here's back to our simple function. We're going to think about how do we prove this proposition about our function square. Now, we want to do this entirely in terms of equational reasoning. So, what's the strategy? Remember the thing is we need to be mechanical about this as well, because we're trying to convince a computer. So, what are we going to do? How are we going to start this? So the idea that we're going to do throughout all the entire lecture, we're going to use basically a single simple technique. If we want to prove an equation, we just take the left-hand side, we try and rewrite it to some expression z, we take the right-hand side, we try and rewrite it to that same expression z, just using substitution, and then if we've got a situation where we've got x equals z and y equals z, then we know that x equals y. And that's a rule that a machine can be programmed to understand very, very easily. So let's see how we would do that. The problem we've got is that we need equations in order to do our substitution. We need to be doing this rigorously. We need to do this mechanically. So we need to know where to start. And a good place to start is with definitions. If you can do all your proofs starting from definitions, they're the best proofs you can have. There's no more rigorous you can get if you can say at the end of a proof, this is true by definition. You know, there's no other way it can be. It's not a matter of looking out in the world and seeing the way things are. It's just a case of going, this is the way that the words are used. It's just definition. So here's some definitions. These are probably familiar to you as just simple algebraic laws, but these really are definitions for numbers. They can, in certain contexts, be treated just as a way of defining numbers. If you do a course in abstract algebra at Edinburgh, this is the sort of thing that you'll be studying. You'll be studying objects defined by equations like this. So we're told at the top, x plus 0 is equal to x, and x times 1 is equal to x. Any know what those kind of equations are called? What that law is called? Identity, cool. Right, so we're being told in the first case that zero is an identity. It doesn't, under addition, it doesn't do anything. It just takes a number and then reproduces it. And they've got the same thing for one. One under multiplication, it just acts like the identity. It doesn't do anything. Next two rules, the technical terms. Commutativity, cool, yep. Doesn't matter what order we do addition, doesn't matter what order we do multiplication. Next two laws. Associativity. Bracketing doesn't matter. We can bracket on the left or we can bracket on the right. It ends up being the same thing. And then finally, last law. Distributivity. Cool. And then finally, we just got this little one here. It's not an algebraic law, but it's just going to be, we said we want to work with definitions. So we need a definition of 2 in terms of everything else that we've got. So we're going to define 2 to be 1 plus 1. Okay, let's see what we can do with that then. So the idea is that we're going to try and prove this proposition, and we're just going to use substitution of what we've got so far. This is trivial, obviously. I understand that we all know how to do algebra. But we need to do this mechanically. We can't just, you know, use our rules that we kind of, you know, we've been learning since we were at school. We've got to actually do this using the equations that we had before, and we've got to do this in a completely mechanical, monotonous way, sorry. So we start at the top, squares x plus y. If we can unfold that, we can use the definition of squares, and so we're back to here. Now, we've got a bracket governed by a multiplication. So we're probably thinking in terms of distributivity. So we expand that out. Again, we've used the law on the previous slide exactly as we had stated it. Right, now what do we do? Associativity? Yeah, we could do. So what would you make? What would you use associativity on? X to X. So we've got X plus Y times X, so we're splitting. Which one are we splitting?
From X plus Y X, you make X squared plus Y X.
X squared plus Y X. Can we do that, though? Here's the problem we've got. Look at the definition of the distributivity law. You see what the problem is there? So we can't use that distributive law directly, right? We have to do commutativity first. So the point here is that we're having to act like dumb machines. We don't really understand maths. We're just going to pretending that all we know how to do is plug in rules. Okay, so the first thing we have to do is we have to fix that. And we have to do the same on this side as well. And now we can use that distributivity law. Okay? Now what we're going to do, it's not entirely clear what we're aiming for here, but what we're doing is we're computing what's called a normal form. We're going to try and use our rewrite rules in such a way that they eventually reach a stage at which we don't want to apply rules anymore. There are various ways to define the point at which we want to stop. Roughly speaking, we want to make sure that all the letters that appear in our equation are in alphabetical order. That's because if they're in alphabetical order, that's just a nice place to stop at. And we want to make sure that all the brackets are bunched up to the right, because again, that's just a nice place to stop at. It's an arbitrary choice, but the point is we want to teach a machine, keep applying these rewrite rules, just keep applying these rules that we've given you. And the machine's going to go, okay, but when do I stop? And we say, right, we'll stop when everything's in alphabetical order and all the brackets are pushed up to the right. So we can do this in a way which doesn't require any real insight. So apply associativity, and now we've got the brackets all bunched up nicely. Still got a problem, though. We've still got this. This y times x means we're not in normal form, because that's not in alphabetical order. So the last thing we want to do is another commutativity step. Okay? Now, to prove our goal, we need to do the exact same thing with the right-hand expression. Okay, so the first thing, we're going to unfold the definition of 2. 2 we defined as being 1 plus 1. Now we can use distributivity here. Now we're in the same situation we were before. We can't use distributivity directly there. We need to switch those around. Oh no, I'm lying. No, that's fine. Yeah, we can use distributivity there. Okay. Now we've got x times y times 1, which should be telling us that we probably want to use identity laws at this point. That can be reduced simply to x times y. That to x times y. And now we're going to make sure, again, all the brackets are always bunched up to the right. use associativity there, and now we're at the exact expression that we were in the last slide. So we've now absolutely convincingly proven that the original proposition is true. And we've done it in a way that a machine could do this. And if you use the theorem provers that we develop here at Edinburgh, that's exactly what happens. Right? You teach them rewrite rules. You give them a bunch of equations and say, this is how you can manipulate expressions just by doing simple substitution. And then you can say to the machines, OK, I've got these two equations here. Do some rewriting on them. Apply these substitutions until you get to a point at which we all want to stop, until an arbitrary point that we've chosen at which we have the right sort of expression, and then see if the things you end up with are equal. So this is proof that really can be completely mechanical. OK, let's go on to something a bit more interesting. Are there any questions? Go for it, cool. Turn all of our
coefficients to 1.
So if you had like 4x, you'd break that down to
x plus x.
Yes, exactly. That's what you'd want to do. So in here we had a coefficient of 2, and we broke it down, and so we ended up with x times y. Yeah, if we can get everything down to primitives, get everything down to just the unit 1 and get everything down to 0, that's the strategy we're going to want to use. Okay. Yeah, good. Cool. Anything else? Cool. So look on to natural numbers now. The problem with what we were talking about here is that I gave you these definitions. And this isn't legal Haskell. You couldn't just type in those definitions. Ideally, when we want to do proofs about Haskell programs, we want to be working with Haskell definitions. You can almost understand the Haskell program as just a system of definitions. And what we're doing is wanting to prove things about those definitions. But we need legal Haskell definitions to do that. So here's some legal Haskell. The natural numbers are one of two things. They're either zero or they're the successor of natural numbers. So successor is basically adding 1, but it's not adding 1. Addition is a complex operation. Addition is defined in terms of successor. Successor is the basis of natural numbers. The whole point about natural numbers, the one thing that characterizes them, is that if you have a start at any given natural number, you can always go, what's the next one? What's the successor? So if you try and generate all the natural numbers you have here, you have 0, you have the successor of the 0, the successor of the successor of 0. It's just like with lists. In lists, you have the empty list and you have a cons. Here, we've got 0 and we've got the successor of natural numbers. And then we can define addition and multiplication just recursively, just like you would define append recursively for lists. So we've got some very simple definitions. And finally, at the bottom, we can define larger numbers in terms of the smaller ones. 1 is a successor of 0, 2 is a successor of 1, etc. And then from this, we can start doing some real proofs. Okay, so let's get on to something a bit more interesting. Let's go on to some a bit more advanced. This is a scene from, anyone know this? This isn't, I wanted to include pop culture images into my lecture slides to make them more fun. I'm not sure this is pop culture, but it was when I was a kid. Does everyone know what it is? Great, awesome. Okay, at least there are people still watching it, good stuff. Okay, so this is the scene in which Blackhead is desperately trying to explain to Baldrick what 2 plus 2 is equal to, and he can't figure it out. He keeps saying, what's 2 plus 2, and what's 2 beans plus 2 beans, and Baldrick keeps going, some beans. And he's perfectly right, he's completely logical. Blackadder can't ever explain to him exactly why he doesn't get it, what he's missing here. Why is some beans? Well, it's correct, there's something wrong about it. The problem is that he's not doing normal forms. So we can actually understand this problem here. If you have to be quite a nerd to actually complain about Blackadder in that way. But we can prove this now. Okay, here we go, 2 plus 2. Is equal to the successor of the successor of 0 plus the successor of the successor of 0. Just unfold the definitions. And then you can apply that recursive definition of addition. So you just move this. You move this over to the front. Move this one over to the front. Just applying this rule here. Applying this rule here. And then finally, successor of 0 plus 0 is just successor of 0. 2 plus 2 equals 4. Yes. You go away from this lecture today and go tell all your friends that today you have proven that 2 plus 2 equals 4. Serious mathematics now. So probably best to actually explain what, why that's not actually so impressive. The situation here is, of course, that we haven't really proven that 2 plus 2 equals 4. I have seen people literally argue that this is actually some sort of substantial proof that 2 plus 2 equals 4. It isn't, obviously. What it is, it's just a bit of proof of program correctness. The problem, of course, is that computers don't understand numbers. And they don't understand addition, they don't understand multiplication. You have to program them in. And you have to program into a computer the notion of obviousness. But it's not obvious how to do that. So you take these recursive definitions, and you've got to make sure that they actually do work. And so proving that 2 plus 2 equals 4 is really just about making sure that your code is correct, making sure that you get sensible results in the simplest cases. But we can do more interesting stuff. We can do more general stuff. 0 plus x is equal to x. OK. Any ideas how to proceed with that? Doing some more equational reasoning? Go for it, sir. Do we have a commutative law, though? It's the thing, all we know at the moment is this, and we know that, and we know that 2 plus 2 equals 4. We have got that. We have got 2 plus 2 equals 4. So if we ever need that in our proofs, we'll get somewhere. But otherwise, all we have is a recursive definition of addition and multiplication. So, any other thoughts? Any ideas?
Wait. The square root.
The square root? I think we're a long way from the square root function at this point. If we could get that far, it would be extremely impressive. But we're still on elementary stuff. The problem is that we haven't got enough rules. We haven't got enough equations. And we haven't got enough logic. So we need something else. Mathematical induction? How many people are familiar with mathematical induction? Bloody hell. Good stuff. Right, okay, cool. So this should be easy then. So the basic principle of mathematical induction says that if you want to prove that a statement is true for all natural numbers, you just have to prove it's true for 0. And then if you pretend it's true for n, and you can prove that it's true for the successor of n, then you've proved it for everything. One way to understand that in a Haskell way is if you take this function here, p of 0 is true, and p of the successor of n given p of n is also true, what are the values of this function? What can you tell me about the function? Is that so? At this point, we know that pn is always equal to true. So the idea of mathematical induction is we have a property that we're trying to prove of all natural numbers. We have to make sure that these can be sensibly always filled in with true. And then we know that the property is true for all numbers. Okay, so going back to identity of addition, we have to do two things when you apply mathematical induction. You have to prove it's true for 0 and then prove the step case. And it's fairly straightforward. Base case, that's our definition of addition. Anything plus 0 plus anything, or which way around was it? Was it anything plus x plus, anything plus 0, right, yeah. And then we have this. This is called this supposition here. Anyone know the name of it? Call it the inductive hypothesis. So we always make the supposition. It's like when you write a recursive function, you're always allowed to use the recursive case. And when you're doing a proof by mathematical induction, you're always allowed to use the inductive hypothesis. Mathematical induction and recursion are very, very similar ideas. So, I mean, one thing which is helpful, actually, is that if you still having some difficulty understanding recursion, but you do understand mathematical induction, just try and feed your understanding of one into the other, and vice versa. So in the step case, we suppose that 0 plus x is equal to x. We suppose that we already have our conclusion. And now we're looking for 0 plus successor of x. Exactly the same principle as before. We're going to use the recursive definition of addition. That comes out as successor of 0 plus x. And now this tells us by our step case, we know that 0 plus x is equal to x. So 0 plus successor of x is the successor of x. And the step case is proved. Any questions on that? So, commutativity. Prove that x plus y equals y plus x. This is more difficult now, because we've got a choice of variables. We don't know which one we're going to necessarily want to do induction on. But you can get a computer to just try both. Or sometimes you can get some insight into the problem. So, base case, x plus 0 is equal to x. And we know the 0 plus x is now equal to x, because that's the thing we just proved. So now we've got the step case. Suppose that x plus y equals y plus x. We have the x plus the successor of y. We know how to unfold that. Successor of x plus y. Successor of y plus x. Where do we go from here? What's that, sorry? So the successor of, in brackets, y plus x. That would be great, because then at that point, we could use commutativity, right? Thing is, do we have that? Do we know that the successor of y plus x is equal to the successor of y plus x? Successor of the successor of y plus the successor of x. Is that readable? Successor, and all this in brackets, successor y plus successor x. Like that?
Yeah.
Okay. So is that equal to that? So our definition, if we go back to the recursive definition of addition. So it tells us what happens when the successor is on the right of the plus. We've got the successor on the left of the plus. This is the problem. What we're aiming for is we're wanting to make sure that this here is equal to this here. But we're kind of stuck at this point. I think we need a lemma. We need to do another proof. So we'll now prove that the successor of y plus x is equal to the successor of y plus x. And again, we use mathematical induction. Okay, so let's use induction on the variable x. Base case, successor of y plus 0. We know how to do that, because we've proven that anything plus 0 is equal to that thing. In fact, that's the definition. Successor of y plus 0, well, we know that y plus 0 becomes just y. So again, these two are equal. That's good, we've got the base case sorted. Inductive hypothesis. So the successor of y plus the successor of x. Right, we know that by definition of addition, that's going to be equal to the successor of the successor of y plus x. And by the inductive hypothesis, that's the successor of the successor of y plus x. And then this one just follows by the definition of successor, or the definition of addition. So again, we've got our step case there. So now we've proven our lemma, and now that we've proven our lemma, we can apply it immediately. Successor of y plus x, so the successor of y plus x is equal to the successor of x plus y by the inductive hypothesis. Good? Does that make sense? Yeah, cool. So where else can we go? Lists. So this is another definition of list. This isn't quite legal Haskell code. It would be nice if it was. But Haskell doesn't actually allow you to define the list data structure because it just doesn't like you define the syntax like this. I don't think it does anyway. But here's effectively what the type of lists would look like. It's saying that a list, it's either empty or it's a cons. And we've got a definition of append here. Empty list appended to x's is equal to x's. X const onto x's append y's is x const onto x's append y's. Definition of reverse. So we've got some simple recursive definitions and a simple definition of lists. Now, we're going to want to do proofs about this, and we're going to want to use mathematical induction again. Okay, so what would be the strategy for doing induction with lists? It's going to be the same deal again, as it just follows recursion. We've got a base case and we've got a step case. And the base case, if you're going to do mathematical induction with lists, is going to be induction on... There it is. It's going to be, we're going to use the empty list. And then for the step case, the inductive hypothesis. Can you give me a stem to what you think the inductive hypothesis would be? So if the, remember the inductive hypothesis in for natural numbers is, well, the general strategy is prove it is true for zero, and assuming it is true for n, show it is true for successor of n. So we, so in the case of lists, we prove it is true for the empty list, and then what do we assume? Go for it. Exactly, great, yep. So it's the same deal as with doing induction with natural numbers. And generally this is gonna, and it's the same way that you would write a recursive function. When you write a recursive function, you always think in terms of the base case, and you think in terms of doing x constant or x's. That's exactly how we're gonna be doing the doing a proof by induction. And general, I mean, this is generally true for all recursive data structures. As you get on further into the course, you're going to be looking at more exotic kinds of structure. You're going to be looking at things like trees. And trees have one base case, and they have two recursive cases. And induction for trees means that you prove it for the base case, and then you have to prove it, you have to prove two step cases. And so the form of induction always follows the form of the data type, in the same way that the recursion always follows the form of the data type. Okay, let's think of an example proof then. Here's the proof that append is associative. Okay, so we start off. Base case, we want to prove it's true for the empty list. We've got three variables to choose from here, and I've kind of cheated and just said that, oh, I know it's going to be z's. Z's is going to be the variable that we're going to want to do induction on. It might be that in certain cases you want to do induction on some of the other variables. And again, you might just have to try all of them and see how far you get. In the base case, x is append, y is append empty list. So this here just reduces to y's. And in this one, this just reduces to x's append y's. Okay, so equal in both cases. In the step case, we suppose that it's true for some list z's. And then x, this one follows by the definition of append. No, it doesn't, sorry. Ah, right. This one, we have to use the inductive hypothesis. We have to rewrite that so that it is now, so that we've actually applied associativity. And, no, hang on. I'm getting confused as to which one has precedence. This one, we just use the definition of append. So the x const can go on the front. Here we have to use the inductive hypothesis. So first of all, we use the definition of append, and now we can use the inductive hypothesis here to produce that. Again, that proves that its lists are associative. Again, this is the sort of thing that a machine can easily prove. Reversing append. This one might be more tricky. Reverse x's plus plus y's is equal to reverse y's plus plus reverse x's. So base case should be straightforward. If we induct on the x's, reverse of the empty append y's is just going to be a reverse y's. That's the definition of append. What about this? Well, we know that the definition of reverse, reversing the empty list is just the empty list. So what do we do at this step? That is? Any thoughts? Reverse? Reverse of y's. Do we have that, though? Do we know that's going to be the case? So again, what's that? So let's have a look at the base of append again. Ah. See the problem? So we can use the base, case of append here. But here, what do we need to do? Yeah. We can prove it's commutative. Well, prove that what's commutative, sorry. Excellent, right, okay, good. So yeah, we want to probably prove that empty list is the identity of append. And then we could see, I've left that out, that's kind of an exercise. Once we finished that base case, the step case isn't quite as difficult. Reverse of x's plus plus y's is just reverse y's plus plus x's, that's the inductive hypothesis. Here, we know how to rewrite that. That's just the definition of append. We know by the definition of reverse how to rewrite this. And we know by the inductive hypothesis that reverse of x's plus plus y's is that. So now we've got it into this nice normal form here. And then finally, we can do the same with the right-hand side. Reverse of y's plus plus reverses x constant to x's. By the definition of reverse, we produce the exact same normal form. So finally, double reverse. That one I haven't got slides for, but that's a fun one to do. So if you think, I like the idea of just sitting down and just playing with some of these symbols and trying to do it in a completely precise way. Better yet, write a computer program to do it. That'd be awesome. Write your own rewriting system. But this one takes a bit of effort, but you don't have to prove any additional lemmas. You can just get it to all go through with equations. Okay, so proof's fun, I think. One of the things that is really nice about Haskell is that it was actually derived from another computer language called ML. And the purpose of ML was basically to do proof. And so you're using a language which really is all about proof. It's difficult, yeah. You have to spend a lot of work trying to get simple proofs through. Trying to prove that append when double. Sorry, hi.
Can you go back to the reverse definition?
Yeah, sure. Yes, it's recursive.
And I think it should be reverse x as plus plus x.
Reverse. Ah, sorry, yes, you're absolutely, no, yes, you're absolutely right. Yeah, we should be reversing that, shouldn't we? is that mistake gone through all my slides?
No, the definition is with reverse, then all the
Yeah, I just need to make sure that, yeah, well spotted. So these are kind of a, perhaps these needed to a bit more work. Yeah, so that's fine. Yeah, it seems like, just the definitions are slightly wrong there, but the proofs are okay. Yes, yeah, you're right. That should be recursive. Okay, and equational proof. You can do proofs in other languages. I mean, to be fair, every language you can do proofs in. Just happens that with a functional language, when you've got when equals can always be substituted for equals, you've got an advantage. And recursion and mathematical induction kind of the same thing. And tell all your friends that 2 + 2 = 4, just in case they weren't sure. You now can know that for definite. Okay? So any other questions? Anything else? Cool. All made sense? Any more general questions about this is an area called formal methods. And we do quite a bit of it actually at Edinburgh. One of the recent successes that we're quite pleased about is that the Java runtime had a bug in its concurrency model, its memory model. And this bug had gone unnoticed for quite a number of years until somebody sat down and tried to push a complete definition, a complete specification of Java's entire language through a theorem prover, going through you having to do proofs at this level in order to get that to work. And it's the sort of thing which you're not going to spot on paper because it's just too many details to keep track of, too much implementation to deal with. So you push it through a computer, and the computer said, no, this doesn't work, and people haven't spotted it. So we do get cases where pushing stuff through theorem provers is a good way to get things verified. Another great example is Intel. I don't know if you remember back in the mid-90s, they had a bug in their floating point coprocessor. And as a result of that, they had to do a recall. It cost them about $500 million. And now they employ a guy who wrote a theorem prover, which is derived from theorem provers first developed at Edinburgh, where he's employed now by Intel just to verify all of their floating point arithmetic in their processors using theorem provers, doing all these sorts of mechanical proofs. Cool, hi.
Yeah, but theorem provers aren't universal, are they?
Not universal. The ones that John Harrison uses, the guy at Intel, he's using a theorem prover which is based on lambda calculus. So there, you've got a bunch of theorem provers which are all lambda calculus-based theorem provers, and they're all very similar. And generally, everyone's confident when something's proved by them. They're generally happy with that. Is that the question you're asking? Or?
Yeah, but you cannot prove everything using algorithms. Like, there's not such thing as algorithms that prove
everything. No. Do you know why? Are you thinking of the halting problem?
No, that's another thing. Well, also a halting problem, for example.
So yeah, and these things, I mean, halting problem, so you've got a halting problem, you've got Gödel's theorem. And they both make the statement that, yeah, you can't get machines to prove everything. It's kind of true, because it's not clear that you can get humans to prove everything either. So it's not, I'm not entirely convinced that that Gödel's theorem is actually a big deal when it comes to doing theorem proving. I mean, there aren't any good examples of theorems which, you know, people are going, we've got this theorem, and according to Gödel's theorem, we can't prove it, but we can. You know, it seems like everything that a computer could prove is something that we could prove as well, so.
Yeah, but can the computers just check proofs, or can they produce?
They can check proofs, usually. They can check proofs in a way which is decidable. This is one of these, have you heard of the P equals NP problem? In complexity theory, there was they can check proofs very, very quickly. Finding proofs, in some domains, they're pretty good at it. For doing your propositional logic, the stuff that you're doing in computational logic at the moment, obviously, they can do that far quicker than humans can. But generally speaking, for arbitrary maths, they struggle even with the proofs that we were doing here sometimes, which is pretty horrible. So one of the ways that we use theorem provers is we actually babysit them. So you kind of you help them on. When they get stuck, you go, try this, and then the automation can take over, get stuck again, and then you push it in the right direction. So you just have to babysit.
So basically,